gun shy now. We'll see what happens here. What we're doing tonight, as was mentioned this morning, we're continuing our series in looking at the entire Old Testament story. And what we are covering tonight, and I think the song we've just sung is fitting, as we look to our promised land, we look to our reward, no tears in heaven, a blissful existence with God. And what our period tonight is all about is here is God's first people that were on the cusp of their promised land, and yet they failed to enter in. And that's a sobering reminder to us as we long for heaven, as we long for a place where there are no tears. There's a lesson to learn from Israel. And in fact, we'll look at a New Testament passage at the end of our lesson tonight where Paul makes that point explicitly about learning from the mistakes of Israel in the past. What we've covered thus far in the first four periods of creation, of course, creation in those first five chapters of Genesis, the basics of human existence and what God has done in creating the world, creating man, and of course, man's sin in the garden. And because of that, consequences of sin. And then we went to the flood and we saw the terrible results of when man followed his own way, when man followed the thoughts of his own heart, and the thoughts of his own heart were evil continually. And so God destroyed the world in the flood, Genesis 6 through 11. But then we focused on the family of Abraham beginning in Genesis chapter 12. And it's there in Genesis chapter 12 that we have those three promises that are made to Abraham. The first two that he makes in the first few verses about how his family would become a great nation, that through him all families of the earth will be blessed. And then as Abraham goes in the land of Canaan, he goes to the city of Shechem, that there in verse 7 of Genesis chapter 12 is where God promised Abraham that he would give to him all of this land. Those three promises that so many of our young people would know. What are the three promises to Abraham? We would say land, nation, and seed. Well, we've seen so far in our study, the first of those promises has been fulfilled. That there at the beginning chapter of Exodus, in Exodus chapter 1, we see that Israel, while in Egypt, in Egyptian captivity, they became that great nation, a numerous people, a people that Pharaoh was worried that he could no longer contain, so he tried to oppress them. And God brought them out of Egypt with miraculous signs and under the leadership of Moses. So as we begin our lesson tonight, just to kind of to recap what happened in the journey as Israel had left Egypt, and they had gone through the Red Sea, and God had destroyed the Egyptian army there in the Red Sea. And in the close of the Exodus from Egypt, we saw that God had brought His people down to Mount Sinai. And they spent about a year there. And during that year, of course, is where, first of all, they enter into that covenant with God. And we spoke at some length about covenant in our last lesson. About that relationship that's formed with God, a relationship that's based on God's gracious promises. A relationship that requires His people to follow Him, though. And that they would just have faith and followed Him. And all the promises that God had made to them would have been kept, would have been fulfilled. Also during that time, they received the law. They build the tabernacle. But after about a year's time, they set off. And they make their way up into the wilderness of Paran. The region of Kadesh Barnea. And Kadesh Barnea is only about 50 miles just to the southern border of where the promised land was. They're right there on the cusp. They're right there where the land can be taken. They're so close, but as we're about to see, yet so far away. The first bit that we'll talk about tonight is this generation of Israelites that God had led out of the wilderness. Sorry, led out of Egypt, rather. They were sentenced to die in that wilderness. You know the story in Numbers chapter 13. God says to the people, all right, I want you to select a man, one from every tribe. So 12 spies are going to be sent throughout the land. Now, just to let you know how far they go, this map shows you. When they are sent into the land, and again, Israel is down in this region. So they send their spies, and their spies make their way all the way through the land, through the northernmost extremity of the land, go a little bit further than what we would typically refer to as the land of Israel. They make their way all the way north, and then they travel south. 12 spies. There are two of them that we typically know by name. Joshua, the son of Nun, who was from the tribe of Ephraim, and Caleb, who was from the tribe of Judah. I happen to like both those guys. You all know my name is Joshua. My parents also gave me the middle name of Caleb. I wonder where they got those names from. So, I've always had an affinity for this story. Well, of course, there are 12 spies that are sent, and they're told to spy out the breadth of the land, to look at the land, to look at the inhabitants, to look at the produce of the land even. So here in Numbers chapter 13, let's just skip ahead in the story, to what is reported when the spies return. Verse 27. The spies say to him, "We went into the land where you sent us." They're speaking to Moses. "And it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit." They had brought back a cluster of grapes, and they had that cluster of grapes on a pole stretched out between two of them. That would say something about the heaviness of that cluster, the size of that cluster of grapes. So they say, "Here's some of the fruit right here." Nevertheless, verse 28, "The people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." Now, you know, here's where Caleb steps in. We'll know from the 14th chapter that Joshua and Caleb both try to get the people to listen. But Caleb here says, he quieted the people before Moses and said in verse 30, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size." Now, certainly they saw some men of great size. Not all the people were men of great size, but you know how fears become trumpeted, and they'd certainly done that. Well, the end result is this. When we come to the 14th chapter, even though Joshua and Caleb, they plead to the people in the 14th chapter, they plead to the people just to recognize that the Lord would be with them if they would go. The people refuse. In fact, in verse 10 of the 14th chapter, all the congregation said to stone them with stones. They're ready to kill Joshua and Caleb, and probably Moses and Aaron along with them. They're ready to kill them because, "No, we know we cannot take this land." And that's when the glory of the Lord appears in the temple, at the tabernacle. And he has a message. "I am going to utterly wipe out this people. They are not worthy of me. I am going to destroy them." He says to Moses, "I'll create a descendants from you. I'll lead that nation into the land." We see this come through time and again with Moses. Moses intercedes for the people. And that's one of those foreshadowing, if you will, of what Christ would do for us. Now here is a necessity that man in his sin cannot stand before God. He always needs an intercessor. A mediator. The high priest would serve that function too. And so Moses, again, stands before the people, stands before them and between them and God, and intercedes for them. God relents from his anger, but he gives out this sentence in verse 20. "I have pardoned them according to your word," the Lord said. "But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurn me see it." Pardon. Generation sent us to die in the wilderness. Only those 20 years and up would live to see the promised land, including Joshua and Caleb, because of their faithfulness to the Lord. Now just think of this, and we'll reflect on this again at the end of the lesson. These are the very people who God delivered out of Egypt with the plagues. These are the very people whom they saw God destroy that Egyptian army in the Red Sea. These are the very people who still have no faith in their God. And so they are sentenced to die in the wilderness. So really what most of this period is about then is what happens during that time. We refer to it as 40 years of wilderness wanderings. It's really about 40 years' time from when they first send the spies in. And again, those spies had gone through the land for 40 days. That's why God says they'll wander in the wilderness for 40 years. But up until the time when they go in and to conquer the land is a period of 40 years. They don't stay in the same spot for 40 years, but that's a period of wandering. Most of that time is spent around the region of Kadesh Barnea, that area I just showed you on the map a little while ago. We don't have a very good picture of it, but here's the region. It's got some vegetation. It's a pretty desolate area, though. It's not an area that's well watered. And so, again, we know God was providing for this people daily, even during this time, providing them food from heaven on a daily basis, and He would provide that food for them all the way up until they crossed over into the Promised Land. 38 years spent around this area. Not much is recorded, but there is one significant event that's recorded in Numbers chapter 16. Numbers chapter 16, you have rebellion among the people. Again, you would think this people would learn a lesson. You know what? Let's just be quiet. Let's just be silent before God. Let's just try to do what He wants us to. Not this people. In the 16th chapter, you have the matter of Korah's rebellion. Now, there are a few individuals that are pointed out here. You have Korah. You have Dathan and Abiram. And one other guy by the name of On, who apparently he's not that central of a figure or one of the key ringleaders because he's not really mentioned later on in the text. Korah was another from the tribe of Levi. He's not from Aaron's family, but he was from the tribe of Levi. Dathan and Abiram were from the tribe of Reuben. Now, again, I could ask some of your kids, and if I asked them what was the first son of Jacob, they could tell me, Reuben. Well, it would seem that these guys, they have a jealousy problem. These two guys, Dathan and Abiram, they're from Reuben. They're thinking, wait a second, our ancestor was the firstborn of Jacob. Why are Moses and Aaron the leaders of the people? They're from the tribe of Levi. And Korah's point is, hey, I'm from Levi. I'm just as holy as you are. In fact, they say, all of Israel is just as holy as you are. Why are you in these positions of honor? God does not respond well to these people that reject His authority and reject the authority of those whom He had appointed over them. What happens is the families, the tents, and the families, and they themselves of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, the earth literally opens up and swallows them. There are 250 others who are leaders of the people who have tried to assert their authority in rejecting Moses and Aaron. And they've been told to bring their fire pans and to put incense on them. And as they're offering this incense to God, fire comes down from heaven and consumes them. And you would think, again, this ought to give a picture to the people of, okay, let's just follow God. Let's just listen to God and do what He wants us to. No, instead they murmur and complain in the same chapter in verse 41. On the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, you are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people. It's your fault. Never taking stock of the fact that they had rejected God over and over and over again. And now in their rebelling against God's chosen leaders, they have rebelled against God Himself. So God sends a plague. And over 14,000 perish. Aaron has to take a censer and stand in the way so that more do not die. I only give that, not because these things are pleasant to talk about, but this is what was happening with God's chosen people, God's covenant people at this time. They rebel, and they rebel, and they keep on rebelling. We go forward. As this period is drawing to a close, we see that Miriam dies. That is the sister of Moses and Aaron. That's in chapter 20. And then also in chapter 20 is where we have what happened with Moses. As the people have again murmured, they have complained, they want water. They're thirsty. God says to Moses, go and speak to the rock. You recall that on a prior occasion, Moses had hit a rock, beaten a rock, and had to provide water for the people. Now Moses told, you go and you speak to the rock. Verse 9 of chapter 20, Moses took the rod from before the Lord just as He had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly in the congregation, and the beast drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me, to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel. Therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." And as we'll see, Aaron will die on Mount Hor before they make their way to the land of Canaan. And Moses is going to be sentenced to go up onto Mount Nebo, and we'll look at that at the end of our lesson tonight, and he'll be able to look over into the land. But note what God said there. "You did not treat me as holy." And I don't think it's just the fact that he beat the rock instead of only speaking to it, but you'll recall what he said there. "Must we," he and Aaron, "must we provide water for you people, when it's God who's provided every blessing all along?" He's not giving glory and honor to his God anymore. He's allowed this people to affect him so severely. I have the utmost sympathy for Moses. Can you imagine leading that people and hearing all the grumbling and all the complaining about you every day? And finally Moses snaps and said, "Here, look what we're going to do. Stop it. Be quiet. You have not glorified me," God said. And so even the ones who would lead the people, they would not be allowed to go over into the land. Well, the next part of our journey and our story here, after they spend that 38 years in Kadesh Barnea, they make their way to the plains of Moab. The plains of Moab, and again, Kadesh Barnea is here in the very southern tip of the land. And this was the original way in which they were apparently going to go up and take the land. But now God has decided they will not go up through the south, and it may be because the Philistines are here, and the Philistines may have been a little bit mightier a people than this people could have thought about taking at first. But he brings them around, and he's going to bring them over here into what are called the plains of Moab. But you'll see here, Edom is in the way. Edom is a distant relative, if you will, of Israel. Of course, Edom is a descendant of Esau, so Jacob's brother. So they've been told, "You cannot go to war with Edom." So they send emissaries instead asking, "Can we pass through your land?" Edom says, "No, you cannot pass through our land." So they are forced to travel around. During that time, Aaron dies. And during that time, it appears again, the people are just tired. Now we're marching more in the wilderness. And so in chapter 21, in verse 4, they set out from the Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the people became impatient because of the journey. The people spoke against God and Moses, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and water. And we loathe this miserable food." Here we are again, blaming God for everything, even though it was the fault of the peoples why they were out there in the first place. And now we're tired of this food. We loathe this miserable food. Why did you bring us out here to die? So the Lord sent fiery serpents, verse 6, among the people. They bit the people so that many people of Israel died. The people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us." And you'll recall, this is where they are told to fashion a serpent out of bronze, to raise it up on a standard. And that anyone who was bit by a serpent, they looked upon that standard, they would be healed. That happened during the wilderness wanderings, and we'll make a point of that in just a minute. They finally make their way, though. They make their way over to the plains of Moab. And what occurs on the plains of Moab would seem to be relatively good news. There's some successes here. These are the plains of Moab. That is on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Some good land there. That will figure into the story in the 32nd chapter of Numbers. You'll also see that this land is inhabited by other people. Sihon and Og were Amorite kings. Those were parts of the people that were to be destroyed by the Israelites. And so, in the 21st chapter, relatively quickly, they have battles against these two kings and take that territory. So all that territory on the eastern side becomes Israelites, the Israelites' territory, when they defeat the king Sihon and then they defeat King Og. Well, the king of Moab down here, he gets to be a little worried. And introduces us into one of the fascinating figures in the Old Testament. It's a really interesting story, and I don't have time to go through all of it tonight, but it starts in Numbers 22. Balak is the king of Moab. And he is worried. He is frightened. Here are the Israelites. He sees what they had done to Sihon. He sees what they had done to Og. And now he knows they're going to turn their attention to him. He and the Midianites. The Midianites were a more nomadic people who are further to the east. Further to the east, living out more in the desert. They said, we've got to do something about this. No one's being able to stop them. We've got to do something. I know, let's send for Balaam. Well, who's Balaam? Balaam was this seer, and I don't know how Balak had heard about him. Balaam's a seer up in Mesopotamia. He's nowhere near Moab. He's up there in modern-day Iraq. But we're going to send to Balaam. And we're going to have him come down, and he's going to curse this people. And you may remember the story. He sends up some of his ambassadors to Balaam. And Balaam says, okay, well, let me go hear what the Lord says of whether or not I can go with you, because the king's promised him all kinds of riches. Let me go see what the Lord has to say about this. So he goes in the night, and the Lord appears to him in the night and says, you will not go with these people. Balaam returns the next morning and says, I cannot go with you. Sends them on their way. Well, Balak said, I don't know what's going on here. I've never been rejected before. This guy doesn't want money. All right, we're going to send more nobles. We'll send more riches. Go back to Balaam again. I said, all right, let me inquire of the Lord one more time. So he goes in at night, and the Lord appears to him and said, all right, but you will only speak the message that I have given to you. It appears that the Lord already knows what's in Balaam's heart, because even on the way, it's somewhat of a humorous story if it weren't so tragic for Balaam. Balaam is riding on his donkey. The Lord has set himself against Balaam. He is now his adversary. Again, I believe he knows that Balaam has every intention to try and find a way to cause a stumbling block for Israel, which he will in fact do eventually. So the Lord appears, an angel of the Lord appears in the way of Balaam. Balaam can't see him. But the donkey can. And so the donkey turns aside into the field. And Balaam says, what's going on here? Beats the donkey? All right, get back up on the path. Well, the donkey goes a little bit further. There's the angel of the Lord again. Appears on. Balaam can't see him. The donkey can see him. Now he's in between a vineyard, and there's two walls on either side. And so the donkey kind of moves over to the side and is crushing Balaam's foot. He said, what are you doing? Beats him again. The donkey goes on further. The angel of the Lord appears again. Balaam can't see him. The donkey can't. The donkey doesn't have anywhere he can go. Just lays down. What are you doing? Starts beating the donkey again. The donkey talks to Balaam. I don't think he'd been taking anything at this point either. But the donkey talks to him and says, what are you doing? This is God's reminder to him. You better only speak what I speak to you. To his credit at first, it seems that's what he tries to do. Three occasions, three times, Balak takes Balaam onto a high place. And they make sacrifices. 7 bulls and 7 rams. And then Balaam says, all right, let me see what God says. He shows them part of the people. Balak says, I want you to curse this people. Balaam says, let me see what God has to say. And I'll only come back and speak what God has to say. And 3 separate times Balaam comes back, not with a curse, but with a blessing for Israel. And then, as Balak is so tired of this and sends Balaam on his way, says, you've done nothing for me, Balaam has one more prophecy. Verse 15 of chapter 24. The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty. Falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter shall rise from Israel and shall crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down all the sons of Sheph. Edom shall be a possession. Seir, its enemies, also be a possession. While Israel performs valiantly, one from Jacob shall have dominion and will destroy the remnant from the city. Then he goes on to describe how Amalek would be destroyed. I believe at first that's a prophecy of David who is to come. David who would in fact do these things and make Israel's kingdom one who would conquer these peoples. But as we push forward. And so many times in Old Testament prophecy, you have this idea of, okay, we get a glimpse of what that prophecy means, and then we go a little bit further and we finally hit Jesus. So David, the one who comes from Israel, this king who is going to come and who is going to set up Israel's dominion over these other nations, is only a foreshadow of the Christ who would come and be over all the nations. That's Balaam's final words, at least here, to Balak. There's a problem, though. We understand this from later in the text. Balaam, at some point, does give some advice to the Moabites and the Midianites. He says, if you want to make Israel stumble, send in your women and send in your idolatrous practices and let them entice and ensnare Israel in those things. And that's exactly what they do. Many in Israel died because of that. Later on in the story, the Midianites will be destroyed because of what they've done. And Balaam will be destroyed. He'll be killed too because he had remained with the Moabites and the Midianites. And he had given this counsel of how to make Israel stumble. Well, though, as we conclude this time period, while they're there in the plains of Moab, Numbers, the 32nd chapter, you have Reuben, Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh. They desire a portion of this eastern side for their inheritance. Moses at first thinks this is a replay of what happened back in Numbers 13, where here's some people that don't want to go in the land. They say, no, we'll go in, we'll fight for Israel, but let this be our inheritance. So those two tribes and a half, they'll have an inheritance on the eastern shore of the Jordan River. It's also while they're in the plains of Moab that the book of Deuteronomy is given. A law is spoken to the second generation of Israel. And that was for, well, we'll talk about that in just a minute. But then on Mount Nebo, Joshua is selected as the next leader of Israel. Moses goes up on the Mount Nebo, and there Moses can look over, and this is actually looking from the Israel side of the Jordan River. Mount Nebo is in modern-day Jordan. If you were in Israel's territory on the western side of the Jordan River, looking over, you would be looking at Mount Nebo right here. So up there on the precipice, Moses could look out, he could look into the land of Canaan, he could look into the promised land, he could know this is where the people were going, yet Moses himself could not go. And so Deuteronomy closes with the death of Moses. And that's the story. That's not a lot of time to go through so many wonderful passages. And so, I just hope that gives each of us some encouragement to go back and read these Old Testament accounts to look at what God was doing here. A couple of things to take away, though. We've paid some attention throughout when there's anything messianic, anything referring to the coming Christ. And there's been some very explicit things. So, for instance, in the very beginning, in Genesis 3 and verse 15, when we read about the seed of woman who is going to come and bruise the head of the serpent. This idea that the descendant of woman one day was going to destroy the power of Satan. Then you have those promises that are given to Abraham and Isaac and to Jacob in Genesis 12, 26, 28, and 49. That their descendants, their seed would finally bless all families of the earth. There's a couple other things in these passages tonight that foreshadow the coming Christ. You have the promise, or the prophecy rather, In Deuteronomy 18, where Moses has been God's spokesman for the people. In Deuteronomy 18, he reveals that there's another prophet to come. Deuteronomy 18, beginning in verse 15. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him. And again in verse 18, I'll raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. Now, there's a way in which this passage would apply to any and every prophet that came forth from Israel. But it's interesting that Peter, in Acts chapter 3 and verse 22, in speaking of Christ and his work, goes back to this passage. And it's interesting that when you look at the life of Jesus and that there were those who were looking for the prophet to come, there was this anticipation of a prophet like Moses who would come, a prophet who would come and give the word of God. Jesus certainly is that prophet. And then that episode we saw in Numbers chapter 21, where here Israel has again murmured against God because of their sin against God. God has sent in the fiery serpents. So many are dying. And so what is affected is an image of the cause of death is raised up that whoever would look upon it would be healed. You'll recall that Jesus says that He was the one who had to be lifted up in John chapter 3 in speaking to Nicodemus. He would be lifted up. He would now be the way in which man could be healed. And so you have that foreshadowing there in Numbers 21. But let's leave with one lesson from this time period. And I'm doing this for a purpose because faith is not a New Testament concept. Faith is a biblical concept. And I believe there's a reason why the New Testament speaks so much about faith is because the Old Testament people of God failed at it so spectacularly. There wasn't anything wrong with what God had given to Israel in the way of His commandments to keep. No, they were never going to keep them perfectly. And there was even a system built into that that would allow them to be forgiven of that. What Israel failed at was faithfulness. Go over again, and I think we've read this passage before. But Hebrews, the 4th chapter. Notice what the Hebrew writer says about this people. Hebrews, the 4th chapter, and verse 2. Actually, we'll start in verse 1, where the Hebrew writer is making mention of that we still have a rest to enter into. Because Israel did not enter into their rest. So why did they not enter into their rest? Verse 2. Indeed, we have had good news preached to us, just as they also. But the word they heard did not profit them, because it was not united by faith in those who heard. Israel's problem was a lack of faith. They did not trust their God. Nowhere is that seen better than in that episode in Numbers chapter 13 and 14. I encourage you to go back and read that. You'll see, what are Joshua and Caleb trying to get the people to recognize in chapter 14? The Lord will be with us. The Lord will be on our side. Let's not reject the Lord. They're always talking about God. God will give us the victory. You'll note, the other spies, when they report about how we can't take the land, they don't even mention the name of God. God isn't found in their talk at all. They have no faith. A people who have been delivered from Egypt, who have been provided for in the wilderness, who God has given everything, they have no faith in God. And sadly, that's played out over and over and over again in this wilderness wanderings. They continue to murmur and complain about God, about their lot, about the leadership. This is a people that has no faith in God. Significantly, when you get to the book of Deuteronomy, God rehearses all of that first generation's failures for the second generation. And then He gives them their commandments again, gives them the law again. But He concludes in this way. And I want to read beginning in Numbers 30 and verse 15. And we're going to go through the first 8 verses of Numbers 31. I'm sorry, Deuteronomy 31. Deuteronomy 30 and beginning in verse 15. God says, "See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. And then I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways and to keep His commandments and His statutes and His judgments, that you may live and multiply. And that the Lord your God may bless you in the land where you are entering to possess it. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess it. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving the Lord your God, by obeying His voice, and by holding fast to Him. For this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them." So Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel, and he said to them, "I am 120 years old today. I am no longer able to come and to go. And the Lord has said to me, 'You shall not cross this Jordan.' It is the Lord your God who will cross ahead of you. He will destroy these nations before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua is the one who will cross ahead of you, just as the Lord has spoken. The Lord will do to them just as He did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and to their land when He destroyed them. The Lord will deliver them up before you, and you shall do to them according to all the commandments which I have commanded you. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. He will not fail you nor forsake you." And then He gives the same charge to Joshua. Do you see what God is doing here? this petition as he concludes this book to the second generation. He's urging them, please have faith in your God. Please, for once, trust in your God. And guess what? If you trust in your God, then your heart's going to be with Him. You're going to follow Him. You're going to do what He asks you to. And then you have every assurance, your God is going to do exactly what He said He would do. When you go over the New Testament, there's so many passages we could go to, we won't have time to. But Paul makes explicit reference to this in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Where Paul brings back to our ears the reminder that God had a people before. And it was a people who had experienced the grace of God. Not in the same way that we have in Christ, but he says in verse 1 of chapter 10, I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud. All passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food. All drank the same spiritual drink, and they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. What's the main point of what he's saying here? Here was a blessed people. They had been delivered by God, that baptism through the sea and into Moses. They had been provided by God, not only physical water and food, but spiritual water and food, and that God had guided them. They had everything they needed. Yet, verse 5, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor less act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example. And they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And note how he concludes, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so you'll be able to endure it. What's Paul saying? My friends, have some faith in your God. Know your God will provide the way of escape. And know that since your God is faithful, you need to be faithful to Him. Yes, we are a blessed people. We are a people who have been ransomed by God through the blood of His Son. We are people who have partaken of the Spirit. We are a people who are so blessed. Paul says, don't allow the lesson of Israel in the wilderness to escape you. Don't allow that lesson that God had a people who were blessed too, and they failed to have faith in their God. That's the challenge to each and every one of us. To as God said to that second generation of Israelites, see, I've set before you life and death, blessings and cursing. Therefore, choose life. We conclude with an invitation tonight. Choose life. Choose life that God offers you in His Son. Choose the life that's available to each and every one of us in Christ Jesus. And if you've not yet chosen that life, you can even this evening. Believe in Jesus as the Son of God. Repent of your sins. Be baptized that your sins will be forgiven. You will have chosen life that He has offered. If we can aid you, won't you come as we stand and as we sing.
In the blood of the Lamb, are you holy?
Yes, Miss Hannah. Remember, that wasn't God who took her. That was an irresponsible person that hit her. That wasn't God. Yeah. All right, we will pray for you, Hannah. Okay?
Are you one?